Now to introduce our featured speaker today. Our next speaker is Rehan Alamahad. Rehan is a member of the Fort Bend County Bar Association, and he's also a partner in the law firm of Alamahad and Zafar. They practice immigration law, criminal law, family law, tax law, and contracts. Today, Rehan will speak to us about immigration consequences of criminal convictions. So, Rehan.
Thank you. So it's a pleasure to be here, obviously speak in front of you. I've been here before, but first time to speak in front of you guys. This is a topic that's very important to me as a practicing immigration attorney. I've been practicing for 10 years in immigration. We go on the radio once every other week talking about immigration, answering immigration questions. And we also write a weekly article on a lot of immigration topics, done a lot of seminars. But what's been happening lately is a lot of people come to our office or they call us and they tell us that, I just took a plea, a criminal plea in a certain offense, and now I want to do such and such for immigration. And we look at it and then we find out that maybe they are, because of that plea, they are now inadmissible, and I'll explain that, and or maybe they're removable, which is the same thing as deportation. So this, we brought it up to Josh and said it's a very important, and he said, look, you can talk to them as long as you don't put them to sleep. Because, there's a reason I have a couch in my office. This stuff will put you to sleep. So I'm going to try not to set a record for the most people who fall asleep in a 1 hour CLE. Yeah, that's right. So we'll try to make this as interactive as possible. Anybody who has a question, you don't have to wait till the end. You can raise your hand. Melinda has told me I need to repeat the question because we're doing this on podcast as well. So if you have a question, go ahead and stop me, raise your hand, and we'll try to address it. You should have the presentation at your table. So if you need to get it, you can get it. Otherwise, you can just follow along. So a show of hands, if you look at right here, I have a few choices here. Which of the following counts as a conviction for immigration purposes? So who says A, probation counts as a conviction for immigration? Okay, a few people. B, deferred adjudication with the fine. Does that count as a conviction for immigration purposes? One person. Okay, a few people. Expunged conviction, does that count as a conviction for immigration? You're going to raise your hand for every single one, aren't you? You read ahead. She read ahead. Don't read ahead right now. Conviction vacated for reasons solely related to rehab. Who thinks that's a conviction? Okay. None of the above or all of the above? Who says all of the above? Okay, you either read ahead or you're smart. Okay. So yeah, it is all of the above, unfortunately. So this is the definition of a conviction according to the Immigration Nationality Act. Term conviction means, with respect to any alien, a formal judgment of guilt of the alien, and I'll define that, entered by a court, or if adjudication of guilt has been withheld, where guilty or no contest with sufficient facts, and the judge has ordered some kind of punishment. So it's pretty broad. And so alien is... The definition of alien includes anybody except for a citizen. So it can include a green card holder. So anybody who is a green card holder and is subject to this, if they leave the country, then they may not be able to come back when we talk about inadmissibility. Basically it does include deferred adjudications, like I said, as long as there's some other punishment with it, a probation, a fine. Juvenile delinquency, according to Matter of Devison, is not a conviction under immigration purposes, but everything else is. Expunged convictions, of course, are. Okay, so again, deferred adjudication, you need a punishment with it. Any of those would count as a punishment. Now, I don't know if anybody, if all of you or most of you have been paying attention to what's going on in Congress as far as immigration goes. Senate did propose a bill last week. It's about 844 pages long. It's going to change a lot of the immigration system. The stuff I'm talking about is not going to change. Now, what they're saying on that is certain people who are undocumented can file for a certain status under that bill, and some people who have certain convictions or a number of convictions would not be allowed to file for this RPI status that is under the new bill. But strangely enough, they define conviction a little bit differently than everywhere else in the immigration code. For them, they won't include an expunged conviction. So if anybody has any clients and this new bill passes and it says, you know, you can't have a felony, you can't have certain things, for that, if you have an expunged conviction, you can still qualify. But for everything else in immigration, expunged convictions still count as an immigration, as a conviction for immigration purposes. All right? So, you know, post-conviction relief, obviously, when people come to us and, you know, they say, you know, I have a conviction, and then we tell them, look, this is what it does to your immigration status, whether it makes you inadmissible or whether it makes you removable, you know, then they want to reopen the case. And obviously, that's very difficult. Now, even if they were to reopen the criminal conviction, if they were to reopen it for ineffective assistance of counsel, that's fine. It won't count as a conviction anymore for immigration. If they only reopen it for solely related to rehab or immigration hardships, and there's no procedural or substantive defect other than that, then it's still going to count as a conviction for immigration. All right? See if I want to add anything else on that. Okay. All right. So a non-pro-tunc will actually change it for immigration. Now, we're going to talk about, you know, the different types of offenses and what their consequences could be in immigration. And a lot of those depend on how much the punishment could be or how much the punishment is. So if it's a reduction like this, then it can actually make an impact on whether there's an immigration consequence or not. Okay, so inadmissibility versus removability. Very important distinction. There is a different standard when a person gets a visa, a person enters the country, or when a person gets a green card versus everybody else who's already here in the country. So you have two different standards. You have 212, which is inadmissibility, and then you have 237, which is removal or deportation. Now, you know, I'm going to use those interchangeably because in 96, the term deportation was taken out of the code and replaced by removal. So it's basically the same thing. It's just a, you know, change in 96, IRA, which was the new code. So we'll talk about inadmissibility first because there's different criminal grounds that relate to that versus deportation. Okay? So one of the ways you can be inadmissible, 212A2A, any alien convicted of or who admits committing acts which constitute the essential elements of a crime of moral turpitude or attempt or conspiracy to commit one, or a violation of any law or regulation of a state, the U.S., or a foreign country relating to a controlled substance. So very broad as far as controlled substances goes. I don't know if anybody has looked at Section 102 of that. It's long. It covers basically anything, any drug you would have come to mind. So we're going to focus on crime of moral turpitude because that is obviously it's a very, very difficult to figure out what exactly a crime of moral turpitude is. Very open to interpretation. There's no statute that defines it. It's only case law. But real quick before we get to that, there's exception to the crime of moral turpitude inadmissibility that I just mentioned. Basically, if you're a minor under 18 and you committed it more than 5 years before admission, then it doesn't count against you. The petty offense rule is the exception that we use the most often in crime of moral turpitude. Basically, it says if the maximum penalty possible, now again, maximum penalty possible, not actually what was imposed on the person, but actually what is allowed under the statute at hand. Maximum penalty possible did not exceed imprisonment of 1 year. So in Texas, Class A misdemeanor has a max imprisonment of 1 year. So it would fall under here if they were also not sentenced to more than 6 months. So we'll talk about that because that is very difficult to understand exactly, you know, what will make you inadmissible in this section as far as crime of moral turpitude. So real quick, here's one example, and I'll ask you guys what you think. Class A misdemeanor for 31.11, tampering with identification numbers. We're going to assume it's a CMT. Would that make a person inadmissible? Who says yes, according to what I just read you, and the exceptions? Who says no? Raise your hand if you think yes. Yes, okay. All right, and who says no? Everybody else? No, one person. Everybody else is undecided. Okay, all right. So the answer to that is no, it wouldn't, because if you go to the petty offense rule and you see that if maximum penalty of 1 year or less is the most you can get, which Class A you can, that's the most you can get, as long as they get an imprisonment of 6 months or less, then it would be covered under that petty offense rule, and they would not be inadmissible because of that. Now, on the other hand, a state jail felony conviction, maximum sentence of 2 years, and so assuming that the minor exception is not met, which I mentioned earlier, then they would be inadmissible. Okay, so CMT, we'll talk about that in a second. So inadmissibility, you know, is something that a lot of people don't realize. There's one example that I have on a case that I worked on in Dallas. We did the deportation and removal proceedings for them. It was a lady who walked into a Walgreens, and her daughter was about 2 years old, and she took a pack of gum. So maybe a dollar worth of merchandise. Walked out of the store, the mother didn't know anything. She was charged with shoplifting, okay? Years before, all right? Years before she was put in removal proceedings. And she took a plea, and she didn't think about it. 6-7 years later, she didn't do anything. She was a green card holder. She never filed for citizenship, which she could have because it was more than 5 years before, because it's a minor, you know, it's not a aggravated felony, things like that, so she would have gotten citizenship. She never did it. She forgot about it. She traveled, okay? When you travel, like I said, you are held to a different standard. You're held to the inadmissibility standards, 212. And so when she came back, she had a theft offense. Theft offense is a CMT, a crime of moral turpitude, okay? And so she came in, they took her green card away, and they put her in removal proceedings. The only reason we were able to get her out of removal proceedings is because of that petty offense rule. Now, obviously, if she would have known about that and not traveled or maybe filed for citizenship, and as soon as we got her out of removal, she filed for citizenship, she got it because the crime was 6-7 years before. It wasn't within that statutory period of 5 years, and we'll talk about citizenship at the very end. But because of that, you know, she put herself in great risk. So a lot of people don't know that they have these crimes, they forget about them, and then they don't realize it, and then they travel. And then that's when they realize what happened, okay? And a lot of times it's too late at that point. If a person is inadmissible, if they come into the country, when they land in the airport, actually, unless they're a citizen, they're actually considered as seeking admission every single time. And at that point, they don't even have the right to an attorney, okay? They could call you from the airport and not be allowed past border protection yet, and you really can't do anything for them. It's very difficult. So it's important to advise them before they even get into this position. So a CMT, the definition, like I said, there's no statutory definition that makes it a lot more fun to figure out what's a CMT. We go by case law. So basically it says the Board of Immigration Appeals has defined moral turpitude as encompassing conduct that is inherently base, vile, or depraved, and contrary to the accepted rules of morality and the duties owed between persons or to society in general. That's a mouthful, okay? So what we've done actually is, because it's very difficult to figure out, you know, on your own whether something is a CMT, we're gonna go briefly into that. What we've done, there's an associate in our law firm that has actually gone through the entire Texas Penal Code and put a list of what could be something that would get you deported, whether it's a CMT or an aggravated felony, and that's on our website. That's going to be up within about a day. So she's already done that. We just haven't put it up yet. So that's on there. So that's a resource for you guys to look at if you ever had a question on it, and then you can always ask me. So that's the definition according to the board of a CMT, and that's been accepted by courts everywhere. The violation of statutes which merely license or regulate and impose criminal liability without the regard to evil intent, they don't count as a CMT. All right? So the next question is, what exactly is a CMT and how do you figure it out based on a certain violation of, say, the Texas Penal Code? So the first thing you do is you look at the actual essential elements under the statute, okay? And if the essential elements meet the definition of a CMT, that's where you stop. You don't look at any conduct, you don't look at the record of conviction, none of that. If the statute only covers conduct that would violate this rule here for CMT, then anything convicted under that is a CMT. But obviously, if anybody's looked at the Texas Penal Code and other states also, there's a lot of divisible statutes. There's a lot of statutes that have A, B, C, and some of them have where it requires intent, some of them don't. So in that case, there is a... So again, this is basically you look at the evidence of the defendant's actual conduct, and I'm going to skip ahead real quick. Right here, we have two approaches to how the courts figure out whether something is a CMT. You have the categorical approach, where you just look at the statute. Like I said, if it's not divisible and everything covered under there is either, you know, has that evil intent, then it's a CMT. If not, then it's not. Then you also look at the second thing. If that doesn't tell you exactly whether it's a CMT or not, you move on to the second approach, which is the modified categorical approach. And in that case, we have a Fifth Circuit opinion as well. You can look at the entire record of conviction, okay? So that includes, I think it's on the next page. That includes the charging document, the plea agreement, the judgment of conviction, any explicit finding by the court to which the defendant assented, and the sentence. Now, it does not include, according to latest case law, now I have the cases down here, Gaspar Esparza Rodriguez is a Fifth Circuit case. They went away from what the previous precedent from the BIA was. The BIA in Silva Trevino in 2008 said that you can include in this record and you can consider it to figure out whether it's a CMT. You can look at the police documents, the police report. Now, this Fifth Circuit case went away from that and said, no, you're not allowed to do that. You're only allowed to look at, you know, the other stuff, which I mentioned, the charging document, all that stuff. So basically, you know, that's a very important distinction as far as the BIA and Fifth Circuit goes. So I'll give you an example of what a CMT is, what it's not. And then we'll go through a certain groups of crimes that could or could not be. So the matter of Balao, which is a BIA case, just to give you an example, a guy was convicted on three separate acts of passing bad checks, okay? And so the judge said that the conviction that he had was under... the statute that only required, it did not require intent to defraud, okay? Even though what he did actually defrauded people, because that statute, the Pennsylvania statute, did not have intent to defraud, in that case, it was not a CMT, okay? So you have to look again at the statute itself, and not just at the conduct and what the result was. All right? So, and then in, there was another case, the matter of Short, which I skipped over going back. There was a person in matter of Short who was convicted of intent to commit a felony upon a minor. Okay? That statute did not even though the evidence showed that he committed a felony, it involved sexual assault, and that is something that makes you removable and admissible. Even though that's what he did, he wasn't convicted of that statute. He was actually convicted of something that did not have that as an element of the crime. Dominguez Mukasey, talk about multiple subsections. Let's see if I can go back here. Yeah, Dominguez Mukasey, again, it's talking about subsections. Certain crimes can be a CMT, certain ones can't. In that case, there was one count of assault, and the Fifth Circuit held that it was that statute, that section exactly that he was convicted on. It did not require that intent that you need for the CMT. It was a simple assault, and he wasn't held to have committed a crime of moral turpitude. In the Gaspar Esparza Rodriguez case, the 2012 one that I mentioned, that one, again, it was an assault, and he was convicted of intentionally or knowingly or recklessly causing bodily injury to another, and that one, it was held to be a CMT. So real quick, we'll go to the groups of offenses that we talk about when we look at CMTs. Crimes versus the person, obviously murder, sexual assault, those kinds of things are going to be a CMT. Crimes involving fraud, there's a very old case that's still precedent right now. Where fraud is an element of the statute, it's always going to be a CMT. Theft offense, only that part of the statute where it requires the intent to permanently deprive someone of their property, that's a CMT. Burglary, it could be depending on what the intent is required under, again, the statute. It could be a crime versus property. It could be a moral turpitude crime. Perjury, bribery, those things are against morality according to case law, so those would be a CMT. Drug offenses are usually not. There is an exception under there, and I have the case law over there where exception, when they had possession with intent to distribute, intent was required. So that was a CMT. But that is one of the few exceptions when it comes to drug offenses as far as CMTs. DWIs, DUIs are usually not a CMT. There's an exception there as well. Again, when you deal with CMTs and you deal with case law and no statutory definition, you know, there's a lot of exceptions in there. Then you talk about the other grounds that would make you inadmissible, where, you know, either you're applying for a visa or you're coming back into the country if you've been a green card holder. If you've been convicted of two or more offenses, regardless of whether it's from a single trial, whether it's from a single scheme, where the aggregate sentences to confinement are 5 years or more, and then controlled substance traffickers, again, anything regarding to controlled substances, in immigration, very, very broad. So you can see that broad definition there. Anybody who has done any of those things, whether it be aided, abetted, in illicit trafficking, or if the Attorney General has reason to believe that you could be. So if you have an offense from before, and maybe it wasn't as bad, it didn't make you inadmissible on its own, the Attorney General can take that and say, well, I have reason to believe that you're going to do it, and they could make you inadmissible. Prostitution, money laundering, all of those things, within 10 years of prostitution, they would make you inadmissible. So if anyone has these offenses and they leave the country, they would not be able to come back. Or they would not be able to apply for a green card, because when you apply for a green card, you are held to the standards of admissibility under 212. Then we move on to deportation. So this is for everybody else who's already in the country, not applying for a visa, not applying for a green card. Yes.
It sounds like if someone who's an alien and is arrested or charged, can they do anything or plead a certain way to not be charged so that it does not later affect their deportation issue? Or is that outside of their control?
Yes, so you can do that. Like I said, what I would use there is think about the petty offense rule. okay? So you want to plea it down where the maximum punishment is not more than a year. If you can do that, then that's the petty offense rule. And then it doesn't count as a CMT that would make you inadmissible. Okay? Any other questions?
Does that include theft?
That includes theft as well. That includes theft as well. You can plead it down. Yes?
And this is just back there somewhere. Earlier you said, you talked about what was considered an admission, and at the time it looked like pretty much any admission of guilt was a conviction. And one slide said under the new Senate bill for CIR, the term conviction does not include a dozen defendants' fines.
Yes.
So I'm a little conflicted there.
Okay. Let me explain to you. So that CIR bill, okay, that section of it only covers the people who are trying to qualify under this RPI status. So, for example, if a person is applying, if they're illegal, okay, and they're applying, say this Senate bill becomes law, and it stays the same as it's written right now as far as this goes, and they file for RPI. Now, if they file for this status and they're illegal, they would be disqualified if they have certain convictions, if they have three or more misdemeanors, okay? So just for that purpose, they're not going to count. Say suppose someone has three misdemeanors, okay, and they're illegal and they're trying to qualify for RPI status, okay, just under that bill or if it becomes law. If they file for it and they have three and they expunged one of them, that would only give them two, only for that proposal, only for that purpose. And they would be able to file for RPI status.
So it only deals with the RPI.
That only deals with RPI, right. Other than that, like I said, conviction is pretty broad. Yeah. Yes?
For a criminal defense attorney that's representing an alien, does he have an obligation to know these laws, or is it one of those things that you kind of cover yourself and say, see an immigration attorney on those issues?
Yeah, so we'll talk about that, but briefly, Padilla. Obviously, we have a slide on that. It talks about that, and it talks about the obligations of a criminal attorney when advising their client. Now, a lot of criminal attorneys believe that all Padilla tells them is, all I have to do is tell my client, talk to an attorney, okay? Talk to an immigration attorney, and that's it, no matter what. Padilla doesn't say that, okay? Padilla holds you to a different standard depending on what the crime is. If you look at the facts of Padilla itself, Padilla had to do with a drug conviction, okay? And if you look at the immigration statute, just basically what I've told you, drug offenses, except for certain exceptions for, 30 grams of marijuana or less, that will make you deportable. That will make you removable. That will make you inadmissible, all of that. And so in Padilla, they said that, look, if it's a CMT or something that's difficult to understand, then all you have to do as a criminal attorney is tell them to talk to an immigration attorney. But for that case, because it was very clear that a drug conviction would have led to deportation, they said, in that case, you have to tell them yourself. So just telling them to talk to a criminal attorney wouldn't have been enough in that case. So it actually holds a different standard depending on the crime. So we have a slide on that as well, but I mean, that's the gist of it. Okay, so going back, any other questions? All right. So we talk about deportation now. We talk about removability. So that applies to anyone else who's already in the country, not applying for green card, not applying for anything. They're just here, whether they're illegal or whether they have a green card or what have you. So if anybody is inadmissible at the time of their entry, or adjustment of status and they didn't catch you at the border, they caught you now, you can be deported. All right, so that goes back to inadmissibility. But the main grounds for deportation, 237, for criminal grounds anyways, 237A2A1, we have our favorite term, crimes of moral turpitude. Here it's a little bit different. It says any alien who is convicted of a CMT committed within 5 years after admission or 10 years for certain green card holders, those green card holders are only those who, there's an S visa, it's basically a snitch visa. If you provided any information to lead to someone else's conviction and then you get a green card through that, then this goes for 10 years for you. And they're convicted of a crime for which a sentence of 1 year or longer may be imposed. So in a Class A misdemeanor, they can impose a maximum punishment of 1 year. And so for that, that is actually, if it's a CMT, they could be deported. Okay, so it's a little bit different from inadmissibility. Okay, certain crimes, even if it's a Class A misdemeanor, in Texas can get you deported. So it's important to obviously plead down, right? Then if you have multiple criminal convictions, any time after you're admitted, is convicted of two or more CMTs, again, not arising out of a single scheme, then you can be deported as well. Then we get to the main point in the main reason why people come to our office afterwards because of a deportation, because of a conviction, because what they pled to may be an aggravated felony. So aggravated felony, this is a definition that is only for immigration now, okay? And so if you're convicted of aggravated felony anytime after admission, you can be deported. So here we have some of the definitions or what's included in an aggravated felony. Murder, rape, obviously, illicit trafficking in a controlled substance, again, firearms, money laundering, crime of violence, okay? Those are points that I'm gonna address later on. We have to go through the definition. A crime of violence for which the term of imprisonment is at least 1 year. So this is actually if it's imposed on your defendant, not what the maximum punishment is, okay? So we'll talk about crime of violence. Then a theft offense, or a burglary offense for which the term of imprisonment, again, is at least 1 year. Anything relating to child pornography, that's an aggravated felony. And then you have M, which is, and again, I focused on the main ones here. It's not all inclusive of what the definition of an aggravated felony is. There's many of them. So you can see I skipped from J to M, but I mean, I can share that with you later, or you can always look at 101A43 for the full list. But I focused on the highlights here. An offense that involves fraud or deceit in which the loss to the victim or victims exceed $10,000. So insurance fraud cases, we've had insurance fraud cases where we've had to try to plea it down and say what the damage actually was to avoid this aggravated felony conviction. So then you have an offense relating to a failure to appear. You have bribery, forgery, where the imprisonment is at least 1 year. Those are all aggravated felonies. And then you have obstruction of justice, perjury, again, where the imprisonment is at least 1 year. Failure to appear before a court, pursuant to a court order, to answer to a charge of felony, where the sentence is 2 years. So those are all aggravated felonies. Those can make you deportable at any time after admission. And again, it's very broad. I mean, there's a lot of things included in the aggravated felony definition. But I'm going to focus on crime of violence right now. Crime of violence is an offense that has the element, the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the property or property of another. Okay, so it could be, a spouse. That could be included in crime of violence. There's another removable section that has to do with domestic violence. We'll address that at the end. So again, you look at the statute and you see whether it actually has this element, use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force. And if it does, certain statutes, again, divisible, certain parts do, certain parts don't. You have to look at the statute and then you can address the record itself. There is, if you look at burglary for Fifth Circuit, burglary, according to the Fifth Circuit, they said it was a crime of violence and it would make you an aggravated felon under immigration. The Board of Immigration Appeals actually said it's not. So there's a distinction there. If you go to court, immigration court, and then you go to the BIA, they're going to hold, according to this case, Perez. But then if you appeal that BIA decision to the Fifth Circuit, then you could have some relief. Simple assault, not a crime of violence, since according to the statute, use of force is not an element. Yes?
At what point is a person removable in the bonding process?
So not until they would have a conviction. Not until they would have the conviction.
Okay, but when are they arrested?
They would arrest them. You're talking about the immigration, if they turn them over to immigration?
Can they be subject to removal in the bombing process? Just have a possession of bombing materials or part of the bombing materials, all bombing, civil bomb, part of the civil bomb.
Right. So once they're arrested for the crime, okay, they could be turned over to immigration, all right? Even if they post bond on the criminal aspect, they could be turned over to immigration if also they're illegal, okay? And then you go in front of a judge, immigration judge at the detention center, and you can post bond. It might be higher depending on this, but they could be released because they don't have a conviction yet, okay? If they do have a conviction, then obviously their removal proceedings will continue, and then they could be deported, all right? But at that point, they could be turned over if they're just illegal also to immigration. Does that answer your question?
Not really, but
okay. Not well, we'll talk afterwards. And let me see if I can go into a little bit farther. Sorry about that. All right, so we talk about death defense only if 1 year imprisonment is imposed. Obviously, this is different from what we talked about in admissibility. And then, obviously, the fraud or deceit part of it. I talked about insurance fraud there. Now, 237A2B, this has to do with the CSA again, very broad drug offenses, can make you deportable. And then also, likewise, firearm offenses, 237A2C, it also is very, very broad. It can make you deportable. I think the next slide on the presentation on your handout, you can go ahead and skip. I took that out. And then go ahead and skip to this one. 237A2E, so this is for family law practitioners. Anybody who practices family law, this slide and the next slide will be very interesting to you. Domestic violence, very broad. Against a person committed by a current or former spouse of the person by an individual with whom the person shares a child in common, by an individual who is cohabitating or has cohabitated with the person as a spouse, or an individual similarly situated as a spouse. And this, again, laws of any state, it will make you deportable. But the one that a lot of family law practitioners don't know about is this one right here, which is that second section of 237A2E, which is a violator of a protection order. That can actually make you deportable, okay? Who knew that in this room? I mean, a lot of family law practitioners don't know that, a couple, okay. So it's very broad again. Any alien who at any time after entry is enjoyed under a protection order issued by the court that violates the portion of a protection order that involves protection against credible threats of violence, repeated harassment, or bodily injury is deportable. So, I mean, that's pretty broad, and family law practitioners need to keep that in mind as well. Depending on a person's immigration status, that could be one other advisal they can make, you know, if their client is subject to a protection order. Now, Padilla, you know, to answer your question, Padilla, 2010 case, Padilla versus Kentucky. Again, it had to do with the drug offense. They held that it was ineffective assistance of counsel because certain advisals were not made. And in that case, it was a drug offense. It made him deportable. He didn't advise them. Then that's why it was reopened. However, Court of Criminal Appeals and the Fifth Circuit have held that this is not retroactive. So you can't go back to a conviction that you've had years ago and say, okay, he wasn't advised, which many people weren't, and they can't reopen the case based on that, okay? So we talk about what Padilla says. Padilla applies in criminal cases, obviously, where the criminal attorney's representation fell below the objective reasonable standard of reasonableness. And third, which is very, very important, the person was actually prejudiced. Okay, so if a defendant says that, you know, I wasn't advised about my possible deportation consequences, and I want to reopen my case because of this. Well, they're going to say, well, what was the prejudice? Were you, I mean, look at the facts. Were you going to, you know, if you would have gone to trial, were you going to get the same punishment? Were you going to get a different punishment? So you actually have to show prejudice, you know, here to be able to use this. Now, the last paragraph here talks about the different standards, what you have to advise, which is what I said earlier. If the law clearly states the alien would be deportable, the criminal attorney must inform his client of the deportation consequences. So obviously a drug offense, other than marijuana, it's probably going to lead to deportation. So if you have that, if you're a criminal practitioner, according to Padilla, you're supposed to tell your client. Anything else that's you know, less clear, like a CMT, which is as clear as mud, all you have to do is basically tell them to seek immigration counsel. A lot of people, what happens is people come to me and say, okay, well, my attorney told me to talk to an immigration attorney, but he told me at the end when I was about to go in front of the judge. You know, and then the judge covered themselves also and said, have you been told that you need to talk to an immigration attorney? Of course they have, because they were told 5 minutes earlier. So obviously that's not the best way to do it, because you don't want, if you're representing your client zealously, you want to make sure that, you know, they know all the possible consequences of pleading. A lot of times you have court-appointed attorneys, and, you know, they want to end the case as quick as possible, you know, and sometimes it just happens where, you know, a lot of people come to our office and they say, this is what happened, and now it's kind of too late. All right, so naturalization, which is the last point that I'm going to cover, and then we'll open up to questions. Naturalization has about 7 requirements. One of the requirements to become a citizen of the United States is you need to have good moral character, okay? So good moral character, they defined by not defining it in the code. They basically said what is not good moral character. Okay, they didn't tell you what is good moral character. They said if you have gambling offenses, you don't have good moral character, you don't have this, you know, it's all under 101F, there's a long list of things. And then at the end it says that even if we hadn't listed anything here, you still may be found to have not have good moral character. So it really doesn't define it. If I talk to a client and they have, usually what I advise is anybody, say they have a misdemeanor and they have probation, okay? Or they have probation and it extended into the last 5 years from today. If they come to my office today and they tell me, look, I had a conviction 6 years ago and my probation lasted a year and a half or whatever, or 2 years, that means that the probation extended into the last 5 years from now. And I usually advise them, it's probably not a good idea to file for citizenship. Wait outside the 5 years, and then if it's minor, you will get citizenship. If it's a felony, you still may not get citizenship, because again, good moral character, they look at the last 5 years, but it does not preclude them from looking beyond that if it's serious enough. Okay, so you know, we've had certain people, they said, you know, I want to file anyways, and if their probation just barely inched into the last 5 years, we can get it approved. Obviously, you need to show that they're a good citizen now and they're doing everything else, you know, for the community. You know, you can kind of rebut that. But for the most part, if they have a crime, if they have probation that extended into the last 5 years from when you're filing, I probably wouldn't file for citizenship. I would wait outside of that. Okay, so I think that is the last thing, last slide I have. Go ahead.
What are the general fees or attorney's fees?
So which situation?
As far as they have pending conviction or pending charge or pending deportation, and yeah, need the attorney to advise them through the process.
So it really depends on the type of relief that they're going to be able to seek in immigration. You know, we haven't addressed on that. There's certain waivers and things like that that you can get. There's asylum. You know, there's all kinds of things that you could possibly go for. As far as the conviction not being final yet, and they just want to consult, I mean, you can, every attorney has a different hourly rate. So I think that is a good thing to do if you're about to take a plea, obviously you want to consult with an attorney, and that, you know, you don't have to put them on retainer. I don't think you should just be able to consult with them. And then otherwise, if they're in deportation, obviously it's going to depend on how, what kind of relief they're going to be seeking, you know, what that entails, things like that. There's things called cancellation of removal. There's things, adjustment of status through a spouse or child. There's certain waivers, you know, so every attorney is going to be a little bit different. It's really going to depend on what kind of relief. Yes?
Do you satisfy if the judge in the plea interrogates the defendant before the plea is accepted about loss of citizenship, deportation? Because all the judges down here in this county are doing it now. They take a plea and say, well, the felony judges are all doing it.
Yeah.
Or the misdemeanor judges.
Yeah. Well, you know, so they'll do it. The judges will do it. From what I've seen, the judges could also say, has your attorney advised you of that? And they're basically covering their grounds because they don't want their conviction to be reopened. According to Padilla, it's actually the attorney who has the responsibility to do this. And what the judge is doing is they're covering themselves because later on they don't want the person to try to reopen it and say, okay, well, I wasn't told. And you know, you have it on the record that the judge asked you specifically, you know, have you been told? So that's why they're covering themselves. But according to Padilla, it is the attorney's responsibility. Any other questions? Yeah.
And with that, the judges here are asking, mm-hmm. Do you know?
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what I was saying. Under Padilla, mm-hmm. Does the attorney's notification have to be essentially an effective notification with enough time for the client to actually go out and act on those?
It does not. Not according to Padilla. Maybe. Yeah, right now, yes. According, you know, maybe case law later on will change that, and hopefully it will, you know, because it really doesn't do any good if you tell the person right before you go in front of the judge, hey, by the way, you know, you need to talk to an immigration. And I've had clients tell me that's when their attorney had told them. And there's really not much to do as far as reopening it because, according to Padilla, that's the standard that they have.
Thank you, Rahan.
All right, thanks, John.
Thank you very much.